Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a conversation with legendary Democratic strategist James Carville with some pointed comments about both Republicans and Democrats. Joel Pollack of Breitbart News, a Pacific Palisades resident, joins us to talk about his recent conversation with President Trump about wildfire relief and what he's seen since. And we also talk with Peter Hamby of Puck News, one of our favorite political analysts, about this wild challenge of covering Donald Trump, and also some new poll results coming in about Karen Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles, and her potential former and maybe future challenger, Rick Caruso. All that this week on The Issue Is, and here on The Issue Is podcast, some extended conversations that we didn't get to put on the air because of time restrictions. And let's start with James Carville, one of the most interesting all-time great guests in the history of political news. Of course, he's perhaps best known for 1992, Bill Clinton's campaign, his phrase, the economy's stupid, which is a reminder to people to be focused on economic issues. He has hosted so many different TV shows on CNN. He was one of Tim Russert's favorite guests on Meet the Press. We know he's married to Mary Matlin, who was one of the top political strategists for Bush, which made a very interesting relationship. He's written so many books, and he was very critical of Joe Biden for running because of his age, very critical about the way that Kamala Harris was selected, not elected, in terms of the Democratic nominee, said it in real time. A lot of that is documented in a documentary called Carville, Winning is Everything Stupid, which is now available on Max. He was in Southern California this week to speak to the Warshaw Conference at USC, which I was honored to be one of the moderators. So while we were there, I said, can he sit down with us? He was gracious enough to do that and was very gracious with his time. We talked about the state of politics today, about Trump, about what went wrong with the Democrats, potential path forward. We also took a moment to talk about Tim Russert, my hero, and his thoughts about the state of the media today, and his thoughts to kids and college campuses. He's spent a lot of time teaching at LSU, and you know, there was a lot of kids from USC in attendance there. And so all of this is included in this conversation with James Carville. I really enjoyed it. I hope you will, too. James Carville, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Great to see you. Great to see you at USC with the LSU on. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's good to be here. You know, one of the things I was telling one of the students, I realized this, USC was a legendary baseball program and actually had a Cajun coach, a guy named Ron Dato.
Right.
I think he's just deceased. He's a Louisiana
Whose name
guy.
Is on the field. It's Dato Field. It's Dato Field at USC.
That's as Cajun as you can get.
It is. So Donald Trump is now president. What do you make of the way that he's acting so far?
So utterly predictable. Can I think of anything? So you have this example, you have this tragic crash. Obviously, it seems to me that this helicopter was grotesquely out of position, but that, you know, negligence. And it's a start on DEI. I mean, you can't, the guy doesn't have a human reaction to an event. It was like you had these, you know, wildfires here. Well, I mean, that's probably when you go back and do your after-action report, or what you're going to have to do. The one thing we know that didn't have anything to do with this was the Delta smelt. Okay? We can pretty much... And how can anybody ever get the right answer when the first answer you come up with out of the chute is entirely goofy? And, you know, I don't think that people, you know, if your original analysis is wrong, you can change it. If your original analysis is insane, and the tragedy is people believe that.
Right, a lot of people do. Yeah. Millions and millions of people do.
Right, and you know, how do people like you in the media space who work hard to try to get something right, and you listen to questions about Delta smelt, and you go, well, you know, was there, how do you pump the water over the mountains? Was there enough pressure? That's all legit. You hear stories that the wasn't maintenance on fire trucks. Okay, that might or may not be true, but I would certainly want to look at that. But it's just stunning how he can come up with the dumbest, most unresponsive response to a tragedy that I've ever seen by my life.
And yet, why do you think he's so popular?
Well, I don't think he's, first of all, let's say he has a lot of intensity, okay? He's never been at 50%. This is not some kind of an overwhelming popular thing we're dealing with. And I think the Democrats have something to do with this. The other thing is, he is a vehicle to explain to you why your life, you thought your life was going to be better. Okay, the immigrants did it to you. The DEI people did it to you. The Chinese did it to you. Everybody else, as opposed to like folks on how can you improve people's lives. And there are a lot of people that are resentful. You know, think of all of these people that make up all of this stuff about Taylor Swift. A lot of these people are just inadequate people. And they're looking for a quick answer as to why their lives didn't turn out very well. Mm-hmm. And Trump is ready to supply that lie to you as he's stealing from you, right in front of you. It's pretty amazing. He's not that popular. That's really not true.
But the Democratic candidate was pretty unpopular. You say that the Democrats started their seventh string quarterback in trying to win in both Biden and Harris.
We played the seventh string quarterback.
Yeah.
All right. And we had to, we weren't allowed to have tryouts. Okay?
Meaning a primary.
Where people would go. And as I said in the piece, and I said here today, if you would have had Bill Clinton and Barack Obama hosting a forum in Los Angeles, okay, with six potential Democratic presidential candidates, you could have put the Coliseum and it would have filled up. Mm. Okay, there would have been interest. There would have been, two successful people that know something about being president, having a conversation. Well, Governor, how would you address this? What would you do? Instead, we got a person that, embraced every goofy identity idea of 2019, 2020, all mistakes, who was running a campaign and didn't run on change. I mean, she played well for a seven-string quarterback.
In a year when 70% of the country thought we were going in the wrong track.
Yeah, we told people we're going to stay. We're going to keep running. We're going to keep running off tackle. Well, they figured it out. They got a 375-pound guy there. You're going to run out of him. Okay, let's try to go over the top.
Yeah.
Okay, it's something. It was almost, and in spite of everything, in spite of starting a seven-string quarterback, in spite of refusing to acknowledge that you were living in a country that was looking for something different, that we were resolute in giving it, we came within a point and a half.
So who is the first-string quarterback?
You got to have tryouts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something you said in real time. This isn't
ever.
So there's this great documentary called "Winning Is Everything, Stupid," which we watch you in real time saying this, screaming from the mountaintop. Guys, look out! We're doing this wrong. We're gonna lose. Listen to me. He's too old. He can't win. Stop it, guys! And people didn't listen to you. Do you think they're listening now?
I think there's some people who think it is in their interest not to listen. I think there's some people that are afraid if we do that, something will go wrong. Well, it might, but the basic truth is something I've always recognized, is I know how much talent there is in the party. I know Governor Beshear, I know Governor Spiro, I know Governor Moore, I know Senator Warnock, okay? I know Mayor Landrieu. I know all these people. Let's get out there. Mm-hmm. And you say, who's the best quarterback? Well, let's throw some. Let's have a scrimmage. Let's have a preseason game. And guess what? When you got that kind of competition, it's going to be good. She never should run for, when she ran, I think it was at her Senate. She barely won in California. It was a bad year.
Okay. She won pretty easily in California, but she was running
as a fellow time for
attorney general. She barely won.
She barely won. Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, she ran for vice president, but she was there. I mean, she never had been in a really competitive race until now. Mm. And you know, well, we had a lot of people that had gotten a lot of different people. I don't think. If anything, like I say, for the seventh string quarterback, she played a little better. She played like she was maybe the fourth string quarterback.
What do you think of Governor Newsom?
You know, I think the guy is very good. I mean, I watched him. He debated DeSantis. I've kind of watched him on TV, the way he outplayed. The problem with Governor Newsom has, he's been visible for so long, and this is not fair. But people are going to say, I think the California thing, although it's the largest block of Democratic delegates, they is, I'm not sure that's a positive. But every time I come to California, I keep hearing that everybody's leaving here. Well, why the f- always stuck in traffic? If everybody's gone, why can't I get around? Okay? It's like somebody stayed. I don't know who it is.
We got some surplus people.
Yeah. I'm sitting, it takes me, you know, an hour and 20 minutes to get from, you know, URC to LAX. I don't know. But he would definitely be, again, he has advantages. He's been governor of the largest state, sixth largest economy in the world, largest block of delegates, but I'm not sure. The other thing is, I don't think anyone cares anymore about where you're from, what race you are, what gender you are, or your identity. That's pretty clear. I tell you, the most underrated event in the modern Democratic Party is the race for party chair. And I'll tell you why. Three white males. Mm. No one has said a word. Mm. No one has even commented on it.
Right.
That would have not have been possible 6 months ago.
Mm.
All right? And to me, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right? Let's just get the first string quarterback out there. All right?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get the person that can nail a third and eight every time they get there. That's the most important thing.
Obviously, the world's changed a bit since 1992, but back at that point, the Democrats were kind of in the wilderness for a while when it came to presidential races, and you and Bill Clinton able to come together. What are the fundamental principles of that race that Democrats can apply now?
Okay, so first of all, it was race, as you point out in the film, that we stuck to, we had a story and we're sticking to it.
Right.
And we're not getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But the one thing that we miss about modern politics is people's political persona, many people come to pass because of a charismatic, interesting person. Mm. So you had all kinds of people meet. John F. Kennedy, I was a Catholic kid in Louisiana. John F. Kennedy inspired me to be in politics. The whole generation of people here, well, Reagan inspired. Look at Ed Goez when he was up here. Clinton inspired people. Obama. We have not had an inspirational candidate since 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That's for 12. It's going to be 16 years in 2028.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit less concerned with the nuances of public policy than I am where people say, hey, I can get excited about this. So we ran Harris. The theory is, okay, we have a female of color here. We actually didn't wear people of color. So they're looking for something else, okay? Mm-hmm. They're not looking for a mirror, they're looking for
somebody to help them. Joe Biden beat Kamala Harris in 2020.
Yeah.
He beat Cory Booker in 2020 with black voters.
He did, easily. It wasn't close.
Right.
And people don't, and basically, the people don't understand, they understand who they're talking to. People are in the Democratic Party. They don't understand the voters in the Democratic Party. We have never elected the most left person, maybe McGovern, but that was the last time.
And that didn't work out so well.
Lost every state except for one.
Yeah.
So, of course. But when people look at Democrats, people watching this show, if I was to say, when you think about Democrats, what do you think? They're old and they're urban. It's about as far as you get. Okay? They're all old, and they're kind of favor the people in the cities. Yeah. Well,
and Clinton and Obama were cool and young.
Yes, were cool, young, and they had, they wanted to have universal appeal.
Yeah.
Okay? And they, neither one ran a narrowly focused campaign. As I remember, 6 days before the 92 election, I couldn't find a candidate. Little campaign mess. And somebody said, he went to Mississippi. So I got on the phone and said, man, what the are you doing in Mississippi? He said, oh, James, you understand. Says, Bill Winter and Mike Espy said, if I came here, that I could carry the state. In other words, he actually thought he could carry Mississippi. So my original thought was to be frustrated. But then I said, you know what? The guy thinks he's a winner. He thinks he can close. I want to see a candidate that says, you just get me to Wyoming, that I can do it.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I know you're not going to do it, but you want to have that kind of attitude going into it. And that's very important. And you got too many freaking consultants now. You got to target this, and you got to do exactly this, and you micro-target that. You end up with incoherent.
Yeah. And sometimes it's as simple as Trump puts on a better show.
Yeah. Right. I mean, he does, he has an arc, he has a narrative,
yeah.
Okay? But what's wrong with putting on a show?
You know how to put on a show.
You want a show, we'll give you a show.
And speaking of that, I just want to talk real briefly just about the media. And one of the best parts of the documentary is you talk about your relationship with Tim Russert, who was my hero and the reason that I got into this business and the reason I created this show. And I'm wondering if you can reflect on what you think Tim might think of this moment and what lessons we can learn from his example at this time when we really could use his voice.
So the truth of the matter is, when Tim was there, it's particularly true in the earlier part of this century, obviously, if you were serious, you had to go and meet the press. And it was kind of a good thing that people, and I think my wife, I don't know how many times, on Tim's show. But, and this is not, it's easy to blame them. The media has nowhere near the power that it used to.
Right.
Remember when Lyndon Johnson said, I lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the war.
That's when Cronkite went to Vietnam.
Now?
And,
yeah. You lose Wolf Blitzer, man, you know, like Wolf, but stuff is cat. Right. And so what happens, people decide, I'm not going on Sunday morning TV and get grilled for 25 minutes. Because I don't have as much of an audience. I have all this alternative media. I have all these other outlets I can go to. And I have people that are going to tell me I was always right in the first place. Tim never told me. He never let you rest on your assumptions. He was always challenging assumptions. But now, I don't, unfortunately, I don't think people want their assumptions challenged. I think they want validation more. And I don't think Tim would have validated some of this stuff. Right? So, and then, of course, he had this, which was very helpful to him. He was, his daddy was a sanitation worker. He was most handsome TV guy that you ran across, but because of that, he developed a like trust for what people were looking for and
real
what they wanted, and that's very important. And he didn't give you the impression that he thought he was smarter than you, but he did give the impression that he worked harder than you did. All right, and that was important at the time, but. And people always say, well, how do we get another Tim Russert? I'm not sure if Tim Russert were in this environment, he would be Tim. I mean, he obviously was very good in the environment he is, but it's now become so diffuse and people have become, we have to think of ways yourself, you know, your challenge is, how do you make the truth interesting?
Right.
Because if you can make up anything you want, then You know, a combination of environmental policy, water policy, irresponsible building codes, insurance companies causing this, all conspired together to bring the tragedy we had in Pacific Palisades.
Yeah.
That's the truth. All right? It was a bunch of woke people protecting some Delta Smelt thing that did, well, that's more interesting. That's easier.
Fiction is easier to write than nonfiction.
Right. Yeah. So how do you make all of these combination of things? And there was some bad, the more I read about it and I live, there was some bad policy. They were green lighting places where they shouldn't have been built. Mm-hmm. Okay? Right. They were insuring, and California was subsidizing. We got the same problem where I live. Mm-hmm. I live in a, you know, by this hurricane prone place, I go to on the weekends on the Mississippi Gulf. I don't have insurance.
Mm.
Now, I'm affluent and older, so I don't have a mortgage. Most people don't have that choice.
Yeah.
But we have like encouraged building in kind of vulnerable places.
Sure.
And then we, you know, but there's all kinds of factors that go into picking this stuff up.
Yeah. And last question, we're here on a college campus. I know you've spent a lot of time at LSU. What's your main message to young people right now about politics and the state of our world?
What I hoped in the movie, you asked me about the film. The film was started with a woman named Susan McHugh, who was a close friend of mine. This was just after the pandemic. She said, you know, I was a student at Rutgers and I saw the war run. And I got so inspired, and she became Harry Reid's chief of staff when she was 30 years old.
Mm.
So what I would hope that young people would take is, this is a kind of fun way to do things. These people don't walk around with a hair shirt, right? That, and that's the origin of the movie was hopefully, you know, I think that it worked somewhat, that young people would see it and they would say, well, I don't know, they had a good time,
mm-hmm.
right? And they get involved because, you know, you cover it. I can tell by talking to you, you like covering politics, you like covering
sure.
big things, you like covering things that matter, you like covering interesting people, mm-hmm. you like covering people that have an interesting story. And, you know, that works so much better than this eat your peas, everybody is wrong, I'm right, I'm morally superior, mm-hmm. I know more than you do. And that turns people off. So that, thank you for asking the question, but that's the real purpose behind the movie, was that some kid here would watch it and say, damn, yeah, maybe I'll run for the, you know, county commission, or maybe I'll volunteer on the sewage and water board, or
yeah.
maybe I'll study water policy, I don't know. A thousand different things. Maybe I'll get into journalism. What about that?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll go cover politicians.
Right.
Then Tim Russett, I'll kind of, you know, hugely influential. Maybe I'll teach it at university. Maybe, I don't know, there's a thousand different ways that people can get involved.
Well, James Carville, you make it so interesting. Winning is everything.
Sir.
Stupid streaming
right.
now on Max.
Yes, sir.
You are the man.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to James Carville. Up next, a conversation with Breitbart's Joel Pollack, who we, you know, have known for years. He was a guest on our first ever episode of The Issue Is. He's a Pacific Palisades resident. Right when this fire was breaking out, he was one of the first people that reached out to me and talked to me about the seriousness of it. He was our first guest, actually, that called into our fire coverage, which went on for literally days. And when we saw him last week in the parking lot before this big meeting with President Trump, he was telling me that he was selected to talk to him. And he was practicing his speech. It went really well. It was carried on all the networks, locally and nationally. But we wanted to talk to him about what happened since. So Joel joined us in studio, and here is that conversation.
I would like to ask you to follow the 9/11 Commission precedent and appoint a special master to watch the money, to make sure that every federal dollar that gets spent here is spent on fire relief and rebuilding and not on everything else.
Good idea.
That is Breitbart's Joel Pollack talking directly to President Trump at his local fire station in Pacific Palisades a week ago, fire station number 69. Joel is with us now wearing the hat from that station. I know this is your hometown. This is your neighborhood. This is so personal for you. I know you've been writing about President Trump, literally talking about him since week one here on this show. As a human being, as a resident, as a reporter, as a conservative, what did that moment mean for you?
Well, it was very important because it is my town, but it's also the town of all my neighbors, many of whom lost their homes, and many of whom felt voiceless until that moment, because we have all been to the town hall meetings or we've watched them on Zoom, and largely what we've seen is public officials congratulating each other for what a good job they're doing. And nobody had yet, until that moment, talked about all the things that went wrong. And we can't control the wind, and we can't control the rain, but there are things within our control and within the local government's control that we didn't do right. We didn't have police directing traffic. We didn't have firefighters pre-deployed. We didn't have water in the reservoir. There are things that we could have and should have done. And I think the president needed to know that we had failed to do those things. I think that the mayor and the supervisors needed to hear it. And after I spoke out and talked about the special master to make sure the money is spent properly, my neighbors started speaking up, and they started talking to the president about how they wanted to get to their property. Mm-hmm. And Mayor Bass said, well, I don't know, maybe within a week. And Trump said, a week's not good enough. And by Monday, the very next working day, the residents of the Palisades could get back to their properties.
Yeah, and we've got some pictures that you have taken over the last couple weeks in Pacific Palisades. What are you now seeing on the ground in terms of a follow-up since that meeting?
Anybody who can get to their property is going. People are sending contractors. People are accompanying insurance assessors. People are taking the first steps to move forward with their lives. There's still so much that's uncertain. But people are grieving when they arrive at their lots, and their lots have been totally destroyed. The houses have burnt down. People are using hazardous material suits and personal protective equipment. They're going through their lots to see if they can find anything, salvage anything. Some people can't, but occasionally people can find some ceramics, or I saw a neighbor find some old photographs even. So people are processing this experience and preparing for the next step.
I mean, that is the issue that Mayor Bass pointed out, this idea that this could be a toxic waste site, essentially, and it might not be safe for people to go back. Are you concerned about that?
I'm concerned enough not to go onto properties that have burnt down. I don't go. I didn't go even before. The mayor said people could visit their lots. I do think that there are concerns, but the local authorities have now said, okay, we're going to provide the hazmat suits, we're going to provide the masks, the respirators, and everything else, and now you're bearing the risk yourself. There are still public authorities like the federal EPA clearing out hazardous materials, and there are other local agencies working on it, but I think people understand the risk and they're prepared to bear it, and they just, in some cases, simply want to see what happened.
So Mayor Bass appointed Steve Soboroff to basically be her czar leading a lot of this. We've got some video of you at a local meeting where you spoke with Steve Soboroff, and Mayor Bass was speaking as well. They talked about this not being a political thing, and then when it started to get political, you walked out of this meeting. There you are with Steve Soboroff. Your assessment of Mayor Bass's leadership so far?
I was disappointed in that meeting. I felt that she was using the meeting essentially to manufacture support for herself. I think there is a lot of public criticism of her job, the fact that she was out of the country, the fact that the emergency services didn't work. What happened in that meeting was that the person who convened the meeting started by saying we should not politicize the fires, and then launched into an attack on Immigration and Customs Enforcement, on ICE. And that's when I walked out, because if you're going to say don't politicize this because it's exploiting the fire victims, and then you proceed to politicize it, then it's not a serious meeting. It's actually a kind of political propaganda session. And at that point, the resident took over the journalist. As a journalist, I should have stayed. But as a Pacific Palisades resident, I couldn't stay, and so I left.
What's the big need, do you think, for your neighbors now going forward?
People need to know that they can rebuild speedily, and they need some certainty about what that's going to look like. And I would also say, having spoken to Steve Soboroff and Rick Caruso and other people who are stakeholders, who have property, who have investments, I think that what we need to see is leadership at that level. We need to see the Soboroffs and Carusos sitting down together and working things out, not at odds with one another, mm-hmm. but sitting down and exerting the kind of leadership that has been missing, and talking to local residents and working with us. I think we also need a more transparent process. Nobody knows what Steve is doing, and that's not necessarily his fault, but nobody knows what he's doing or how he got there. Nobody knows what's coming out of Rick Caruso's nonprofit about rebuilding the Palisades. There's just a lot of confusion. So I think having them sit together, work together, and work with the Trump administration, which is going to appoint a special master to make sure the money is well spent.
And do you know who that's going to be yet?
I don't yet, but Rick Grenell is taking the lead for now in California.
Who had worked with him as the ambassador to Germany before, Southern California, and who was in that meeting, who Trump right. pointed to in the meeting in real time when you brought it up. There was a moment of hope this week, which was Fire Aid, this incredible, massive concert at both the Forum and the Intuit Dome. You got a chance to go to it.
Live Nation was incredibly generous. They organized some tickets for children, teenagers mostly, in Palisades who had lost their homes. I reached out to them and they actually provided some tickets so the kids could see the show, and I was the chaperone. There's another show also on Saturday for the firefighters, and some people are going to that show instead who couldn't make the Thursday one. But it was absolutely incredible and really important, I think, for the kids to reconnect to music and to feel some joy. And at first I was uncertain how it would feel because life seemed to have gone on for everyone else in the arena. Not everybody was from the Palisades, and it's a party. Is it really appropriate to have a party? But once the people on stage talked about their own homes, because so many of the musicians and Billy Crystal, the comedian, they are residents of the Palisades. Some mm-hmm. lost homes, some saved their homes, but there was this direct connection between the audience and the performers that was incredible.
So what was your favorite moment?
My favorite moment was watching the Black Crowes perform a cover of Led Zeppelin's Going to California with Slash sitting in on guitar. Amazing.
All right. Thanks to Joel Pollack and everything that he has done for his community has been really commendable. Now to another Southern California resident, Peter Hamby of Puck News and of Snapchat. He joined us on this sort of wild week of President Trump's extraordinary executive actions and leadership and taking the lead, and where do the Democrats go and how do they even handle this? We talked about all that. We also talked about Rick Caruso and Karen Bass and sort of the battle for leadership of Los Angeles. Peter's one of the smartest guys I know in this space, and appreciated the fact that he joined us in studio to talk about all this. Here's Peter. Peter, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Great to be back, Alex.
It's crazy that we're still in January.
Still much January.
Has happened. How are you thinking about Donald Trump and everything that he is doing at one time?
It's reminding me of what it was like in his first term. Just the always-on spigot of news and takes and push alerts and frantic texts, both with friends and family, but also with sources. And I know you were just in Washington, but I was talking to my producer for my Snapchat show. Normal guy. And he's like, during the Biden administration, sometimes we had to search for story ideas every day. Mm-hmm. Now we don't. This is intentional. They've always said, this is a maxim of Steve Bannon from back in the day, to just flood the zone with information. What's different about this time is there still feels like a little bit of shoot from the hip chaos. Trump can't resist picking culture war fights and saying inflammatory things, which we saw from the White House podium just the other day after the plane crash above Reagan National. But they are also much more deliberate. And so there's substantive news there with all of these executive orders. We'll see how much substance gets through Congress, but there is hard news to cover every single day, every single minute, almost in a way there wasn't in 2017.
Well, and it seems like they are most strategic on immigration, which uh-huh. is what the people around Trump actually really care about. Mm-hmm. You don't hear them talking about the price of eggs all that much, but yeah. you see them really focused on immigration.
Yeah, I mean, your pal Bill at Fox has been covering the border
illusion
for many years. And here's the thing that Democrats are finally admitting, mostly in private, some will say it publicly, you know, Trump was kind of right about immigration in the sense that the American public was extremely queasy about all the people coming here from the border, whether they're people seeking asylum from, you know, political discontent in a Central American country or elsewhere, or if they're just trying to come here to work. Mm-hmm. People were not okay with that. And Joe Biden said in that 2020 debate, basically, come here. And you know what? Migrants listened, and America wasn't okay with that. The thing that is very popular are deportations. Like, it is extremely popular strategy, these executive actions and telling ICE to go into various cities and round up criminals. No one's really against that. I talked to Governor J.B. Pritzker last week or on Friday about this in their ICE raids in Chicago. Chicago is a sanctuary city. You know, even he, who is a guy who's willing to punch at Donald Trump, is basically not sure what to say about this. We need comprehensive immigration reform, but we should definitely deport the criminals. You know, the Trump hardline immigration policy, you know, there's nuances to how public opinion polls respond to it, but generally speaking, it's pretty popular.
And he's producing this like so many other things, like a TV show, right? Having media people in bed with
Dr.
ICE
Phil.
Going in there. Yeah, Dr. Phil, the main reporter we all look to for our facts on this stuff. And you're seeing it all play out in real time. And the Democrats, for much of this last 2 weeks, have been kind of paralyzed without anything to say until they got to this spending freeze, which may or may not be happening. And then the Democrats all of a sudden pounced.
Yeah, the spending freeze, which according to various reporting, they might have been too trigger happy with that. You know, they rescinded it the day after, basically because a lot of states were saying their Medicaid portals were being shut down. A lot of the grants that were, you know, included in this order could have affected just people's day-to-day experience with the federal government, healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid being probably the biggest one.
Meals on Wheels.
All of those things. And so you're exactly right. Prominent Democrats haven't really known how to talk about Donald Trump since losing the election. You know, there's fights about identity politics. You know, the Democratic Party this week, according to Quinnipiac, has reached its lowest approval rating in the history of the Quinnipiac poll at 31%.
Wow.
Never, like, this is, they are in the pits. This reminds me of 2005. More than anything else, after George W. Bush got reelected. But after a couple flubs, and this gets to sort of the chaos energy that Trump has, along with the more deliberate experience, you know, they're smelling a little bit of blood in the water. The question is, Democrats spent 4 years under Trump, and even under Biden, basically just reacting to Trump. And they should. They should pick certain fights. But the long-term question for Democrats is, what are you guys for? And how do you break through in a media environment where Donald Trump is talking about DEI from the White House podium and blaming the plane crash, or at least correlating it to that?
So how do they?
You know, I asked Governor Pritzker about this yesterday. He said, and I know this sounds kind of boring to us political reporters, it was wages, you know, working people, kitchen table issues. And then I asked him, the Democratic governor of Illinois, who might run for president, by the way.
Is going to run for president.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Real.
Let's say it out loud.
Right.
I said, you know, Democrats ran on abortion rights in the last election, and Kamala Harris did talk a lot about economic fairness and, you know, taxing, tax cuts for the middle class, et cetera, and you still lost. And he acknowledged Donald Trump won the economic argument in the 2024 election, but he did say a lot of it was environmental. You had an unpopular incumbent president with Biden who was forced out of the race, and then, you know, inflation was very real. But inflation currently is still real. I mean, everyone talks about the price of eggs. Price of eggs, still pretty high.
Yeah, and potentially with bird flu, it could go even higher. On powers that be, one of the things you guys analyze is the media. And we hate the phrase the media because now that's so many different things. But how are you thinking about how to cover Donald Trump when you have 200 executive orders on one day? Which one do you pick? Where do you focus? How are you thinking about this?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I will say is compared to 2017, which was very jarring for the country, the election felt like a fluke. And to us in the media, it did too. Unsure how to cover him. I don't want to say the media has adjusted. I think we still respond to pretty much everything. But I don't think the press, and I saw this in the White House briefing on Thursday after the plane crash, they don't seem afraid of him in the way they did last time. He doesn't like the media. He attacks them. He realizes he's got many channels. Caroline Levitt, the new press secretary, isn't afraid to attack the media. They just feel like a little more comfortable with him because they've been around him. These are reporters in Washington. But, you know, it's just going to be a hard 4 years. It's a long slog. I know I have lots of reporter friends in Washington who are bracing for just a lot of hard work. Like, it's going to be very, very busy. There's no easy answers.
But in credit to him, he's talking to the media. Yeah. You think about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who barely ever engaged in an unscripted way. Yeah. And Donald Trump, like him, don't like him, he's talking constantly and giving new material and answering a ton of questions.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's unambiguously a good thing for a president. The question is, how do you cover him in response when you're writing the headlines, when you're choosing which push alerts to send out, et cetera? I mean, a good example is the New York Times the other day, a couple weeks ago, sent out a push alert about Donald Trump's rambling press conference. I think this was right before he was sworn in. And I thought back, has the New York Times ever sent, did they ever send out a push alert about any Joe Biden rambling press conference? Yeah. You know, that gets us some sort of cultural and political bias in the media, but you know, it does feel like the press is just, last time there was a ratings boom and a click boom, and like people were making money in news organizations. In just the last 4 to 8 years, eyeballs have shifted more to our phones. All these cable news networks are down in the ratings. They're bleeding staff. A lot of places are doing layoffs. Like, it's not the same as it was in the first Trump term. In other words, the Trump bump in the press.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll see. There's maybe some little ratings bumps here, but you know, the press was getting a little bit of a sugar high off Trump last time. This time, it just feels like they're knuckling down and trying to grind through it without expecting, you know, all the big boom in ratings that they had last time.
Yeah, and unclear about their own future and at the same time. And then you see him settling with news organizations and Cord and all the rest of it, too.
That's
fascinating. And so a weird sort of dynamic happening. As we're talking with Peter Hamby of Puck News, a question about what we're seeing here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. In addition to talking about all the national stuff, you live here in Southern California. You've been impacted by the fires. And you've been seeing what's happening with Mayor Karen Bass. I know you sent me this poll. We want to put it up on the screen, talking about her approval and disapproval rating. This is a recent poll. 54% disapprove, 37% approve. So what happens if Rick Caruso, who of course ran against her and lost by about 10 points, got into a race against her this time? According to this poll, Rick Caruso at 43%, Karen Bass at 36%, 21%. Undecided. This is a Decipher AI poll. Your reading of that and this moment and what Rick Caruso has been doing.
That poll, I mean, I should say, was, I believe, commissioned by a Republican-leaning media firm. I think they did Nathan Hawkins' DA race. That kind of California Republican.
Yeah.
Caruso's number in that poll, lower than his final number in the mayor's race, we should say. Unambiguously bad numbers for Karen Bass in that poll. She can improve that. We'll see if she runs for re-election.
She's already declared that she is
running before the mayor's race,
so she would have to pull out of the race.
The thing,
or before the fires.
I wrote a column about this for Puck a couple weeks ago, and an astute veteran of many mayoral offices told me that mayors come into office and they get two things. One is something they chose, and one is something they didn't, something that happens to them, in other words. Karen Bass was elected promising to clean up homelessness. Her television ad said, there's a fire at home and I'm running home to put out the fire. You know, that doesn't sound great in hindsight. But the thing that chose her is the fire. And most regular voters in any city don't think on a daily basis about what their city council person is doing, what the mayor's doing, even what the governor's doing, until it really hits home. So she has been defined, and this is largely a communications issue because the mayor of Los Angeles doesn't have a ton of executive powers, but she's been defined by not being here for the fire. So, you know,
for the first day, she came here after, in fairness to her.
Correct.
Yeah.
But she did leave after being aware of the fire threat.
Right.
That's the important thing.
Right.
And that's the thing that most people know about her now. That's the thing. She was kind of a cipher, generic Democrat, had made progress on homelessness, I think we should say, along with the city council. But, you know, now this is what she's known for. It's very hard for any politician. I've been around so many losing campaigns at every level. It's hard to crawl out of a hole. It's really, really hard. As for Caruso, you know, he seems like, you know, Palisades guy, loves the Palisades, clearly. You know, the question for me, and I know you've been talking to sources about this too, is does he run for mayor or does he run for governor of California?
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that after the fires, after the Democratic Party basically bottoming out last year, there is room not for a Republican governor of California, but for a self-styled independent, a strong executive. Who else in the state could pull that off other than him? And I think that's what he's thinking about.
I mean, he had said to me before the fires that he was strongly considering running for governor. And I think part of that reason was because he didn't think there was a path to run for mayor because Karen Bass looked like she was a lock for re-election. Now, there may be a path to run for mayor, which may be what he really loves, Los Angeles. But the thought also could be California governor, way more powerful, way more important of a job. Yeah. And if he's got a path for that, maybe go for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. That's the choice. I do think he really cares about Los Angeles. Like, he's an L.A. guy, when I've talked to around him. You know, Karen Bass loves Los Angeles, too. I'm already envisioning the campaign next year, and it's the Sky News interview where they caught Karen Bass in the airport. Do you have anything to say to the citizens of Los Angeles about the fires? Blank stare, nothing. Mm-hmm. That's a killer. That's a killer ad. How do you... Like, Rick Caruso could run a single-issue campaign against her about not being here and not showing leadership. Again, we have L.A. County. We've got the fire department. We've got the Department of Water and Power, all these agencies, like all these overlapping authorities where we live here in Los Angeles County. The one thing the mayor has to do, the one thing, is show leadership, set an agenda, and be a leader in a time of crisis. And we all have friends that night who weren't sure what to do that first Tuesday night of the fires, whether you're in Altadena or Palisades, looking for some kind of guidance, leadership. Should we flee? What's the air quality like? And typically you would look for a mayor to be like the person to step in and give you that update. But she wasn't here.
And she wasn't here to call into our news broadcast, but Rick Caruso was with his criticism of her.
That's the other thing. She's also kind of been in a defensive posture with the press, not in the last few weeks. She did a walk and talk in the Palisades with Steve Soboroff and brought reporters along, but she's not jousting with reporters. She's not on offense. And one thing I've learned about her is, and I kind of made a mistake in my column that I wrote about her, that she was a detail-oriented member of Congress who, you know, liked to get her hands in the weeds of policy issues. Someone called me who'd worked with her on Capitol Hill and said, it's actually not that, even though she's good at that sometimes. It's more that she's a consensus builder. That's that community organizer thing, right?
Locking arms.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of like the Kamala Harris's prosecutor thing. She's always going to be an attorney. Not that she's not an incredibly talented politician, Kamala Harris. And, you know, a community organizer, bring people together, find consensus, could be good for Los Angeles over time, solving something like homelessness, housing, but in a crisis, when you need a leader,
right?
I feel like a lot of people in this city and people in Democratic politics here didn't feel that from her.
Right, and so the question is, where does she go from here? Open invite, we'd love to have her on the show and hear more of her perspective. Peter, thank you so much sharing your perspective. We really appreciate it. And we go to break with some exciting news about our show. A special thanks to the Golden Mike Awards for nominating The Issue Is for Outstanding Public Affairs Show for our special about Father Greg Boyle. They also nominated our sit-down with Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi for Best Podcast.
Our thanks to Peter and to Joel Pollack and to James Carville. What a week of conversations with some really smart and interesting guys this week. And next week, we're going to be joined by Billy Bush. The Extra host has a new podcast and show out called Hot Mics, talking to some people that have been canceled like he was. He's got such interesting things to say about politics, his time with the Bush family, of course, the entertainment industry today, and watching that change and everything. I'm really looking forward to talking to Billy, who is really funny and interesting and just a great conversationalist. So Billy Bush will be on The Issue Is for the first time next week. Thanks so much for listening this week. Hope you tell people about our show. Send me messages. Love to hear from you in social media. And love the fact that you are listening to The Issue Is. See you next week for more.